I have a foreign policy and a domestic policy. Foreign policy is you should never go to war unless you plan on winning. And a domestic policy is those that work ought to live better than those that don't. It's very simple. But I phrased that wrong. It wasn't those that work should live better than those that don't. It's those that work ought to live better than those that won't. There's a slight difference. My time's up, isn't it? You're pulling at my leg here. I have one other thing, a very serious issue. Just coming out of committee is the conference report on the bill that sets up, I forget the exact bureaucratic name, I think it's the Bureau of Population Control. And I'm afraid, you know, that was the family planning. I've got seven kids, you know. I won't go into... What are those moans out there? We've got our first seven kids. How does that grab you? But I'm not speaking from just my own personal experience here, but I'm very concerned about when they set up this Bureau of Population Control here. And I'm a little disturbed that a lot of conservatives have gone along with this. They think, well, you could take these bad people off of welfare, and, you know, maybe we ought to do something like this. They have some strange idea that their people are the ones that are going to control who gets to have kids and who gets to live and who doesn't. I mean, it's things aren't going in that direction for anyone, any conservative, to, even if he doesn't see the big issue of letting the government decide when life begins, when theologians and doctors have been arguing that all along. Once they decide that life begins at a certain stage of pregnancy, they can go, and some of these weirdos have even advocated that maybe we ought to not... Maybe we ought to push the abortion age up even after birth. Take a look at what they look like before we see if we want to... No, I'm serious. I joked a lot here. This is the direction we're going. And when you give that power to government, we're going in a real bad direction. When you give the power to government over life or death, as one of the articles in Review of the News said, why are they doing this? Simply because they're trying to test to see how far they can go. And maybe that's the answer. Just see how far they can go. Life and death over the government deciding who gets life and death. Well, I could go on and on. My 9 minutes are now up, but I would just like to tell you this, that after 5 months in Washington, and I was elected in 70, not 69. I was just elected on June 30th, reelected in November. But after 5 months in Washington and 6 years in politics, political life, I can truthfully say this, that... The John Birch Society does have the right approach. The politics will follow. This is not a political organization. It's an educational organization. The politics will take care of itself if you can educate the proper number of people. And Robert Welch, you know, I've disagreed with a lot of things in the Birch Society and with Robert Welch, but darn it, he always turns out to be right.
That was Congressman John Schmitz of California. The next speaker is the master of ceremonies at the dinner, Rex Westerfield.
John mentioned the population control. One of our members told me the other day that the best thing we could do to purify the air was just ask the liberals to stop talking. To introduce our principal speaker this evening is a man who served as a naval officer overseas during World War II, entered the field of journalism immediately after his war service, and today owns the largest chain of State Farm magazines in the world with a combined circulation of about 750,000. He also owns American Way Features Incorporated, a 31-year-old syndicate serving newspapers nationwide with weekly columns and cartoons. Through his column Straight Talk, he is unquestionably the most widely read and quoted editor in the South and the most widely read farm editor in America. He is past president of the American Agricultural Editors Association, a winner of many National Patriotic Awards, and a long-standing member of the John Birch Society Council, our very own Tom Anderson.
Short but sweet chore this evening. Makes me as excited as Justice Douglas on his fourth honeymoon. The man I'm going to introduce, eventually, is the only presidential candidate I've ever been privileged to introduce. In fact, I guess he's... the only one since Barry Goldwater I would have wanted to introduce. He became a judge in 1952 and had a famous Donnybrook with the feds in which he refused to surrender the records to the Civil Rights Commission, but turned them over to the local grand jury instead. He then appeared in federal court and pleaded guilty to criminal contempt charges, but did not bring the records. The federal judge declared him not guilty, which led to a verbal battle between Wallace and the federal judge in Montgomery, in which our hero called the federal judge, quote, an integrating, carpet-bagging, scalawagging liar, close quote. On January the 14th, 1963, George Wallace became not only the governor of Alabama, but the leading spokesman for the South, and later for the nation, on states' rights, individual property rights, free enterprise, and constitutional government. His efforts were largely responsible for the passage of 7 amendments to the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which greatly diluted the outrageous stipulations of the original bill. The hottest thing in America in recent years has not been the Vietnam War, nor even the back seats at drive-in movies, but the school busing of children. And the foremost and most effective opponent of that illegal and unconstitutional travesty is our speaker tonight. When he was prevented by law from succeeding himself, his lovely wife, Lurleen, ran for him and polled the largest vote in the history of the state of Alabama. And in the last general election, George Wallace, again governor-elect of the sovereign state of Alabama, polled 74% of the total vote. Those of us who oppose Socialist Party A and Socialist Party B, the new Nixon and the old Nixon, are smeared as beginners and perfectionists and kooks. We who oppose the tyranny of one man, one vote, anarchy, treason, aid and abetting the enemy, no-win wars, confiscatory taxation, insolvency and surrender, and demand a return to constitutional government under God, are smeared and called sick. Like the fellow who'd gone to a psychiatrist for many, many years, but who was making his last visit. Since this is my last visit, and I'm now cured, he told the psychiatrist, kiss me goodbye. I'm terribly sorry, said the psychiatrist. I can't kiss you goodbye. We really ought not to be lying here on the couch together. Yeah. Sitting here on the couch with me is a great American, the governor of Alabama, my friend, George Wallace.
Well, Tom, thank you very much for your gracious introduction. I can hardly wait to hear what I have to say myself. For many years, we have been listening to the two major parties in this country telling us how their programs will solve all of our problems. And in the 40 years since the Great Depression, We have adopted every socialistic scheme the National Democrats and Republicans have proposed, but can anyone truthfully say that either party has improved our system of government? Can anyone really say that things are getting better in America? We've advanced in science and technology. Of course, we have a higher standard of living, but all is not well. The savings and earnings of America's working men and women and our retired citizens are being eaten by galloping inflation, caused primarily by irresponsible federal spending and runaway federal deficits. Our working men and women deserve better treatment from the federal government than to have their earnings heavily taxed and to have their take-home pay diluted by government-created inflation. The working man and woman are the mainstay of our economy. And I can recall the recent march of 200,000 hard hats, which illustrates and personifies that happening here in the great Queen City of New York. Their contributions to building America are so great it would take all night to enumerate them. Surely a man who spends his life making a living by the sweat of his brow is entitled to look forward to a satisfying retirement. Instead, we find senior citizens living on meager pensions, not given to them by the government, but earned by years of hard work. We find they are faced with fear and frustration brought on by the shrinking value of the dollar. We in America owe much to the working man and to our senior citizens who made possible so much of our present prosperity. But we cannot allow the government to turn that prosperity into starvation for the wage earner and the retired worker who is living on a small fixed income. Their patriotism and loyalty to America deserves more than the constant pay cuts which inflation brings on. These are the Americans that have borne the brunt of every war. And I know from political experience in my own state and in the country that it is this main mass of American citizens who are someday in the not too distant future are going to turn the tide. They are the Americans that sent their sons off to fight for our nation. They are the Americans whose sons lie in graves in military cemeteries all over the world so that you and I may have the freedom to meet here tonight in New York and to express our views. The working people of America are the ones who turn out for patriotic parades, honoring our country and our servicemen. From the working force of America comes the patriots which the news media has dubbed hard hats, who believe in standing up for America and fighting if necessary to preserve our freedom. So I say America's working man and woman deserves a better break than they are getting out of Washington. But they will not get that break, and neither will you or I, if the federal debt isn't cut and deficit spending isn't stopped cold. I know you realize, especially you, that in 1961 the federal budget was $98 billion. By 1966 it had grown to $135 billion. This year it has reached $196 billion. That's about 100% increase for this decade. President Nixon forecasted surpluses for 70 and 71, but instead we wound up with a deficit of $2.9 billion this year, and a joint congressional committee predicts a deficit of $13 billion next year. The power to tax is the power to destroy. This statement was first made by the U.S. Supreme Court over 150 years ago and referred to the question of the state of Maryland's right to tax a national bank. However, the truth of the statement is being brutally brought home to the average American taxpayer in 1970 as he is in grave danger of being destroyed by an ever-increasing federal income tax. Yes, taxes are on the verge of bringing the working man and the average citizen to economic destruction, and if he is destroyed, the American economy is destroyed. For the average wage earner is the backbone of the American economy. And since the federal income tax system came into being, the middle income and wage-earning American has been a forgotten man when it comes to benefiting from tax loopholes and tax breaks. Why? Because a decent, hard-working average American has never believed in special favors from the government and has never sought to pressure his government for such favors. The average American wage earner belongs to no special interest group as such. His only special interest is to use the best of his ability to provide the best he possibly can for his family. While some of the super wealthy seek the tax loopholes and the professional poverty folks seek some sort of guaranteed annual income, the average wage earner keeps busy by working for a living for his family. Therefore, as tax favors are granted to some, and more handout schemes are thought up to give federal money to people who refuse to work for a living, the working man is caught in the middle American. While Mr. Average American foots the bill, some of the super rich and some of the militants and activists who refuse to work for a living conspire to make him pay even more. We're afraid to walk the streets at night in our major cities because if you're knocked in the head, as I used to say, walking out of this building tonight, the person who knocks you in the head will be out of jail before you get to the hospital, and on Monday morning they'll try the policeman about having made an arrest in the matter. Supreme Court of the United States, they are the ones that have brought it about. And I know to talk about the Supreme Court as a governor of a state, I've been raked over the coals by people saying that it's not dignified. You ought to be more dignified as a governor. Well, I'm a redneck from Alabama, and I'm not so dignified. And I used to say that the Supreme Court of the United States doesn't have enough legal brains to try a chicken thief in Barber County, Alabama. The current FBI report showed that during the decade of the 60s, serious crimes increased 11 times faster than our population. From 60 through 69, FBI figures show that serious crimes increased 148%, crimes of violence increased 130, against property 151, and our population only increased 13%. Aggravated assaults 102%, rape 116, robbery 177, burglary 117, larceny 199, and auto theft 168. Yes. The time that I'm speaking here tonight, there will be committed in this nation an average of one murder, two rapes, 15 robberies, 15 aggravated assaults, 120 burglaries, 90 grand larcenies, 60 auto thefts, and 270 other serious crimes. And I doubt if you'll get 2% convictions, even if everyone who perpetrated the crimes were arrested on the night that they committed them. Yes, things in America not as they should be. Race has been pitted against race. And I want to tell the New York Times again, and the Time magazine, and the Newsweek, I see you. and you are very pretty. well, I lost my place. What was I going to say? Anyway, to you who always, you know, you're the victims, those who, you're super patriots, they call. Well, what's wrong with being a super patriot? I can't see anything wrong with it. You are patriots. You're against communism. But they made it otherwise, that you're something evil and bad. And because I have talked and spoke in my state about the state of Alabama deciding matters of domestic democratic policy, that makes me a racist and makes me a bigot. And I have never in my life made a statement that reflected upon anyone because of who they happen to be. And I say tonight that the American dream is a better life for every citizen of this country, regardless of his race or color, creed or religion or national origin. I've said that in Alabama, I say it here, and during the time that I serve as governor of Alabama, I will be governor of all the people, regardless of their race, creed, religion, or national origin. But, yes, well, and you know, the New York Times, I'm going to cut out some of this good stuff in this written speech to get maybe to the New York Times. I'm glad you're here. But you know, the New York Times talks about you, talks about George Wallace. They've said many things about us. They've said many things about good candidates for office in this state that were not necessarily true. But the New York Times, as I've said many times, doesn't know it all. You know, I can recall that years ago they said Mao Zedong was a good man. He was an agrarian reformer. He wanted to help the poor people of China. Well, we folks in Alabama could look at him and knew that he wasn't just an agrarian reformer. But the New York Times helped bring him to power and helped tip the balance of power to the communist world by saying Chiang Kai-shek himself was corrupt and that his government was corrupt. And I want to say that I had the pleasure last November of an hour and one half's conference with that great anti-communist and that great man, Chiang Kai-shek, in the presidential palace in Taipei, China. And the New York Times then came along and said Ben Bella was a good man in Algeria, and everybody here knew that he wasn't a good man. And then the New York Times said Castro was a good man. And some of the folks with their suave looks on television brought him to the United States and introduced him as the George Washington of Cuba, Castro. And the New York Times said he is the Robin Hood of the Caribbean. And every average citizen in Alabama and every member of this society could look at old Castro, and by intuition, you knew he was a communist just by looking at him. We didn't have to read any books about it, but the New York Times didn't know it. And one reason today that we in the trouble we are in so far as balance of power is concerned, and fighting domestic and international communism, is the New York Times, the newspaper, New York. In Alabama, that's what you when you say that in Alabama, that means you're putting the hay down where the goats can get it. I don't know where you folks in New York understand that expression from Slap Out Alabama, but that's an Alabama expression. Yes, they have pitted race against race, economic class against economic class. So-called liberal church leaders advancing the alien theory that God is dead. Thousands of our youth involved in crime and hooked on narcotics. And the liberal left-wing news media is attempting by the minute and by the hour to brainwash our children and to lull Americans with the false belief that there is no communist conspiracy in the world today. I'm not a preacher of doom. I am not the eternal pessimist. I am a realist, and I say America better wake up. We'd better shake off this hypnotic daze of materialism and creeping socialism. We'd better take a good hard look at what is going on around us in the country. Wake up to the threat to our freedom, our system of government, and our very lives. And I know that someone in some of the Times and some of the other papers wrote that George Wallace in Alabama, when he was governor, he spent a lot of money. He built a lot of roads. He spent money on roads. He spent more on building colleges and medical schools and docks. Yes, I did. But I want to tell them I didn't spend a dime in Yugoslavia. I didn't spend a dime in Algeria. I spent every dime of it in Alabama for capital investments that has brought $3 billion of new and expanded industry to our state during the period of time that ours involved in government. Both the Democrats and Republicans have been telling us what they're going to do for us, but all they've done is to put us in the mess unequal in all history.
We hear next a commentary by Conrad Lynn.
Today, I want to comment on one of the fears of the left, which I'm sure many people feel is a case of crying wolf many times too often. I'm sure most of us have often heard of the tendency of the government toward repressive legislation. We've heard a great deal about the lists that the counterintelligence carries, about the surveillance on people's phones, about many other aspects of government espionage on the private lives of individuals. That this is not just a crying out of fear was illustrated to me this afternoon when Clifford Thornton, the famous jazz trumpeter from Connecticut, came in my office to report about how he was refused permission to keep an engagement to play at the University of Nanterre in Paris on February 17, 1971. He arrived early that morning at Orly Airfield in Paris. His passport was stamped correctly. His disembarkation card was ruled valid. But while he was walking off the field, two French security officers took him aside and told him that he would not be permitted to stay in France. In a few hours, he was put back on the plane and sent back to the United States. The February 18th issue of the Hartford Courant carries this note. The American jazz trumpeter Clifford Thornton was refused admission in France Wednesday because Frontier Police said he was suspected of membership in the Black Panther Party. A U.S. consulate spokesman said Thornton was turned away at Orly Airport in Paris when his flight arrived from New York because the French police said he was on the Ministry of the Interior's proscribed list. Thornton was to have appeared at a concert at Nanterre University this weekend. He had played in France previously. The next day, the Hartford Courant carried a further story. The American jazz trumpeter Clifford Thornton refused admission to France because of his activities in behalf of the Black Panther Party, returned to New York Wednesday night after a quick round trip to Paris. He said in an interview at Kennedy Airport that Paris police had shown him a letter from the French Minister of the Interior dated last December 8th that proscribed his entry because of his Panther activities. Clifford Thornton told me that he had spoke at a meeting in Paris in support of the Black Panther Party. He is a friend of the Black Panther Party. He is not a member, and it is inconceivable that the French would have taken exception to him unless he were on the secret passport list about which the New York Times of Thursday, February 25th, reports a suit about. This passport list of more than 284,000 people describes the persons that this government feels to be subversive in some way. And now Clifford Thornton has had this applied to him, and he lost $1,500 on a contract that he had at the University of Nanterre and other places in France. I think it is much more understandable when one such incident is applied to a friend that we know. and then we can see how the government's program is leading us toward a police state. The young former counterintelligence agent who testified before the subcommittee of the Senate yesterday said that as far as the lists that the government maintains on individuals are concerned, we already are in a police state.